and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Welcome back to My Alchemical Bromance. My name's Eric Arneson, and I am here with Dan Attrell, who is known online as the Modern Hermeticist. He's got a website called that. On that website, he's got the Encyclopedia Hermetica, which is this huge collection of podcasts and videos about everything. We'll talk about that in a second, probably. He's a PhD student at the University of Waterloo, which is in Ontario, Canada, where he's studying the history of religion, science, and magic. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this because you're you have just the right collection of nerd cred in for my liking.
Nice. It's always good to accumulate the nerd cred.
Yeah.
Is there any better cred, really?
I think it might be the only cred that counts, right? It crosses boundaries and languages and time.
Exactly.
So you are. Or you've just finished, or you're somewhere in the middle of co-translating the Picatrix.
Right. So we're done.
You're done.
It's off to the publisher.
Okay.
It's just being proofed right now so that they can kind of like settle on the like what basically sizing up the pages and settling in the printing and stuff like that. And then they're sending that back to us and we are going over like a quick final edit of it. Mm-hmm. And then settling on the page numbers so that we can make an index. Because Ooh. Without an index, a 370-odd page book is useless.
So
we're going to do that, and then it'll be released in the first quarter of 2019.
I feel like part of that was a little bit of a dig at the Greer and Warnock translation, which does not have an index.
Oh, well, that's more just, it's a dig at, like, any book, really, that doesn't have an index.
I agree.
I just spent all week trying to put together this paper on humanism, and I'm combing through all these books, and most of them have pretty good indices.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you come across one, like a thick book, and you're looking for a specific topic, and you know, it kills you. You got to start scanning through every single page looking for the book, and you might as well reread the entire thing.
Yeah, I've run into that too. So you deal with a lot of old stuff, so you probably go through a lot of primary sources.
Right.
When was the index invented? Like when
the
did
index?
Yeah, when did books start having indexes? Because, you know, when you look at stuff in the 18th century, I don't know that I've come across.
The index began in either probably Alexandria, or if like the modern index as we understand it would have begun in the monasteries where it's all about cataloging library books.
Huh.
Right? So, you don't go up and dig up all these manuscripts because they're fragile and you don't want to like get your paws all over them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have everything in an index that's like chained to a wall and you go and find it and crack that open. And then you go find the monk who's going to find the book for you. And then he goes and gets it for you and he'll chain it to a desk and then you can use that book. And that's kind of, I think probably the earliest, instance of an index that we have, but I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah. That I was just thinking about that. Cause I actually yesterday was, combing through some Masonic books from the early 1700s, and it's a pain to find stuff without an index,
right? Because
you really do have to pretty much just reread everything.
Yep.
Okay. So, well, you know, having PDFs, searchable PDFs, really helps.
Yes, it does.
So tell me a little bit about. I'm kind of curious, like with the Picatrix, what primary did you translate out of? Did you translate out of Arabic? Did you use a Latin manuscript? Like, what did you have?
So the version that we translated is the same version that you've got the Greer and Warnock version in your hand there. We both translated from the version put together by a guy named David Pingree,
mm-hmm.
who everybody in the occult community should know about, because David Pingree is just this like titan of learning and like brought so much information from especially Indian, like Vedic astrology,
mm-hmm.
To the attention of the West. And so he was like a classic like orientalist in the scholarly sense of the word. and did great work. So he cobbled together all of the manuscripts that were floating around Europe in various editions, and then created a critical edition.
Okay.
And so there's like numerous manuscripts, and like the Apparatus Criticus outlines all the various traditions that went into making that version. Mm-hmm. But that's been kind of the standard edition in Latin that all the scholars refer to. And that version has nothing to do with the Arabic version. Like, it was translated from Arabic, mm-hmm. and then it was translated into Castilian Spanish, and then from Castilian Spanish into Latin. And then in its Latin form, it circulated in Europe at Montpellier and like Krakow University, uh-huh. and these other universities all around Europe. But the people who were reading this had no knowledge of the Gayat al-Hakim, which mm-hmm. is the Arabic version. And so we actually, when we were translating it, we made a conscious effort not to try to force that system to a close. We wanted to keep those two traditions as variant traditions. There is one tradition, the Picatrix, which has influenced Europe. Right. And then there is the Gayat al-Hakim, which is another tradition altogether. And there are other scholars like Dr. Liana Seif who are working on that version. And, you know, we have no competence in Arabic, so we're not the right people to be mm-hmm. looking at that version.
So do you think that there's going to be a translation of the Gayat al-Hakim? Is that what you're calling
yes.
it? Do you
yes.
think there's going to be an English translation of that available one of these days?
Yeah. So Liana Seif is working on that edition. There actually is, I think it's like book 1 and 2. So there's four mm-hmm. books in the Picatrix, and I'm pretty sure if it's not book 1 and 2, it's just book 1. Somebody has done a translation from the Arabic, and I've like very briefly looked at it because mm-hmm. I didn't want to like contaminate my vision of what the Latin says with what the original Arabic, like I didn't want to like color it.
Yeah.
I wanted to come at it clean, like somebody who would have been like a scholar of magic or theology would have come to it from a European perspective. So yeah, we have no idea. Another tradition that we have is we have a German edition.
Uh-huh.
And that's by Ritter and Plesner, and they worked from the Arabic version. So there's a lot of people who they work from the Latin version, and then they're also cross-referencing it with the German version, which is a translation of the Arabic. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting kind of like a stream of information from a separate tradition. And like, you know, that's fine. It's just it's all a matter of how you outline your methodology at the beginning of the book. Like, what is your intention? And are you clear about what edition you are passing on? Because technically, there is no 400-page version of the Picatrix that ever floated around. It was always in like manuscript versions. Some were truncated, some were fragmentary, mm-hmm. some were full. Like the Krakow manuscript is pretty thorough. And then our modern versions are kind of like cobbled together versions of all of those.
What? So in going through the Picatrix, so you find a lot of stuff in there, definitely influenced. Some of the more famous Renaissance magicians, you know, you can see like Agrippa definitely got stuff out of the Picatrix.
Absolutely.
And I think I heard you mention in another podcast that maybe John Dee had a copy of the Picatrix too.
Oh yeah. He probably had one. The thing is that he actually inherited a library. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Saint Andrew's library. I have this written down somewhere, but I'm not going to dig it up right now. Mm-hmm. But he inherited the largest library in England, basically, because during the, you know, English Reformation, all the monasteries got shut down mm-hmm. By mandate of King Henry VIII. And so basically all of their wealth, all of their riches, including their libraries, were just plundered, and they were sold off wholesale. And so John Dee acquired one of these, basically the largest library in England, and there are copies of like the Liber Wakai, the Book of the Cow, or I think the Secret of Secrets is another one that is a hermetic book that has Hermes Trismegistus giving aphorisms in it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't actually have proof that he distinctly had a Picatrix, but it really wouldn't surprise me. And also the Picatrix fits squarely within that worldview that John Dee and Edward Kelly were living out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So tell me some stuff. I want to hear like some cool Picatrix anecdotes. Like I've read the Greer Warnock one, and I was actually really surprised by some of the content of the Picatrix. But as a translator, you must have come across some things where you were translating it and you're like, this can't be right. Or what the heck is actually being said in here? Like, give me some, what are some juicy Picatrix bits that sort of threw you for a loop when you were reading through it?
Oh, I mean, there's so much to talk about because, like I said, it was an 8-year project. So, so it took 6 years for the actual compiler. So here's the thing, actually, there was a lot of controversy around who actually put together this book. Oh. So everybody since the Ritter Plesner edition thought it was this guy named Al-Majriti, and then they weren't so sure about that, so they switched over to pseudo Al-Majriti. And then you have like, so it's not Al-Majriti and it's not pseudo Al-Majriti, so who is it? Well, we have good reason to believe that is a guy named Maslama Al-Qurtubi. And
Al-Qurtubi, that name is really familiar. I wonder.
Right. But I'm sure if you were to Google Al-Qurtubi, you would not get that Al-Qurtubi.
Oh,
right. Because it's like if you were to search Smith.
Yeah.
And then you were like, oh, man, this Smith guy, he doesn't sound like he's got anything to do with ritual magic. It's just because he's like a totally different guy. So I'll get his dates. The Al-Qurtubi that I'm talking about, he died in the 10th century, and I think it's around 964 is his death date. And he was described by his contemporaries as a man of charms and talismans.
Ooh.
And so he was likely, so what we're seeing is that like the Picatrix was written a long time before it was translated into Spanish, and then but it was still done in Spain, right? So that was something
So Al-Qurtubi was in Spain?
Yeah, he was an Andalusian polymath.
So that's interesting. I guess the impression that I got from the Picatrix, or at least from the, like, I guess some part of me wanted to connect it to like the Haranian pagans or something.
Yes, that connection is there.
And how what is that connection then? If
so, it's really complicated. But I'll lay it out kind of simply. So the Picatrix is written in Andalusian Spain, which is, you know, Islamic, and it is drawing on a wealth of Arabic literature or Greek works that were translated into Arabic or Syriac or Babylonian, or like all manner of texts were somehow found their way into the Arabic. So the Picatrix is cobbled up. I think it's 224 books. The author tells us that went into the making of the Picatrix. And so each of those 224 works have their own separate traditions, but there is one of those traditions, one of those veins is the Sabaeans of Haran, who are in an area of eastern Turkey. And now it's weird because in the Quran there are provisions for protection for Jews and Christians, basically people of the book, people who have received revelation before Islam. And And so Islam was meant for the Arabic people. Judaism is meant for Jews. Christianity is meant for the Christian world. But there was another category, and it was the Sabaeans. Mm-hmm. And these were the star worshippers of the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And we don't know really who these people are. But when the Arabs start conquering outward into pagan lands, mm-hmm. these people start reading these texts and they say, wait, hold up. We are these Sabaeans who you claim are protected. Mm-hmm. We are the star worshippers. So then you get this like new category of people who call themselves Sabaeans in Haran in Eastern Turkey, but they're not necessarily the Sabaeans who were in the Arab Peninsula. They're just like, using that as a title,
right,
to protect themselves. And those people practice basically Babylonian astrology, mm-hmm. and sacrificial ritual magic. As I mean, we wouldn't call it magic, we would just call it religion. And it's only by being a stranger to Islam that this becomes magic. So you're taking Babylonian paganism and you're importing it into Islam, to Spain. And the people who are reading about this, they see this as magic,
okay.
As nigromancia. That's the word that they use, mm-hmm. in the Latin. I don't know what the Arabic word is, but ritual magic or ceremonial magic. Some people like to call it necromancy. I don't like that term, because of modern baggage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like you read Lord of the Rings, and when Tolkien is talking about a necromancer, he's not talking about like undead wizards who summon skeletons. He's talking about just a magician. Whereas nowadays with video games and popular culture and stuff, you say necromancer and then everybody thinks like,
oh yeah, he's got zombies.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, I'm trying to distance myself from that by mm-hmm. translating nigromancia as ceremonial magic,
yeah.
or ritual magic.
That makes sense. So one of the things that that struck me about the Picatrix is that when it comes to the part where it's talking about, like, they have all these recipes for incense,
mm-hmm.
and the quantities that you're producing are enormous. Like, you're not, yes. making like a personal amount. You're making enough incense for like a whole village of people.
Right. And that's the thing. It's a huge quantity. It's like 20 ounces of opium or hashish or whatever mixed mm-hmm. in with like a bunch of other biting agents and such. And then you're using that in not always, but often in an enclosed space. And you're definitely going to get effects from that.
I guess the impression I had was that maybe it was such a large quantity because some of the Picatrix stuff was intended for like a temple or like temple worship stuff instead of just individual practice.
I mean, that's very possible.
Yeah.
That is kind of like, there is an element of there's a recognition that these are ancient religious practices of pagans, and that like, yes, now we worship Islam, now we follow the law, but before the law was passed, this is what the wise men of every civilization practiced. And it was sacrifice, it was suffumigation, mm-hmm. it was costumes and you know, the whole sympathetic magic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
They very much tap into various traditions, but I think there is kind of an overarching tradition which has come to be called Platonic Orientalism,
and that's just Orientalism.
Yeah, it's just the idea that like the East is somehow more mystical than whatever it is you're practicing.
Mm-hmm.
So you couch everything that you do in Eastern baggage, because like. So it's you know, like in the Bible, a prophet is never welcome in his own town. Mm-hmm. Well, it's like a magician is never welcome in his own town because he's just practicing his mom and dad's religion. He needs to go and pretend to be practicing Haranian or Hindu or Babylonian or Amazonian shamanism or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
in order to enhance their I guess, mystical aura. And
I see what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, you're a Freemason, right?
Mm-hmm. I am.
Freemason as an organization is, like, founded on this conception of Platonic Orientalism. Like, it is just, like, deeply encrusted and encoded with, a veneration of the East. Like, what is it? Ex Oriente Lux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's also just, like, stealing. Yeah, you know, the whole thing is based around, the Temple of Solomon and.
Right.
And sort of
Zoroastrianism behind that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what that is a historiographical tradition. It's kind of like you can see even starting from Herodotus and onward that like in the so-called West, we have people who try to like project themselves outward in order to satisfy that kind of like urge for mysticism, the kind of exotic elements that are unveiled by magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Something on my computer was making noise again.
All right.
So then, do you think that there's a connection? So you were saying like, so the Picatrix stuff is. Maybe has roots in Babylonian astrology and that sort of stuff.
And everything. Well, that's the thing is that it's like, it's got a Nabataean strain. It's got a Haranian strain. It's got a Greek strain. It's got an Indian strain and it's mm-hmm. and an Egyptian strain. And it's very conscious in what way it inherited different things from different traditions. So like they're like from India, we received like suffumigation and mantra. They call them just magical words, mm-hmm. but we would call them mantra nowadays. Or from Babylon is where we got the science of the stars, whereas from the Greeks we got the science of like mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is like you are kind of collecting and gathering all of this knowledge from all of the corners of the earth, and you are reconciling and marrying them together. And once you've created this kind of heap of knowledge, you can stand on top of it. And from there you can do magic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's like the goal of the sage. It's you reach the highest degree of perfection in your knowledge. And then you are privy to the secrets of the universe. That's their worldview.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Whereas like we have no center and we're kind of just drifting around and you know, there is truth surely, but like there is no ultimate narrative of what is true that we can just, you know, digest in an evening mm-hmm. or put into a 400-page book.
Yeah. Maybe a math book.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. So then the Picatrix, it entered Europe in medieval times or somewhere around there.
In 13th century.
13th century Latin translations. Where do we see it pop up in Europe? Like, are there some interesting people? Like, we already mentioned Agrippa and maybe possibly Dee, but who else was reading the Picatrix? Who else got influenced by it? Like, what other?
Well, Marsilio Ficino is probably the biggest name.
Really? Can you tell me how do we know that?
I don't have the exact reference, and I will bust ass to find it, and I will let everybody know. Uh-huh. But it's like, if you go in his three books on life,
mm-hmm.
There are, like, sections in the section that's, like, on how to cure depression.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about, like, he's talking about the saturnine nature of the scholar and how, like, scholars tend to have to do certain things to, you know, fight back the melancholy.
Uh-huh.
And in there are talismans and recipes. And if I'm not mistaken, some of those recipes are taken from Picatrix. And I will have to confirm that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the language that Ficino uses and the style of the magic that he's describing is pretty much 100% that worldview. So even if he's not reading the Picatrix, he's tapped into this Renaissance magus. I don't want to say that the archetype precedes the existence of these people, but that what we understand as Western esotericism, he is practicing that in its kind of original form, the form that the Golden Dawn would eventually be interested in. Mm-hmm. Sympathetic magic, resonances, planetary magic, all that kind of stuff. And also Kabbalah, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's the Pico della Mirandola angle to it. Right. So, yeah, and I think Pico as well probably had access to the Picatrix as well. Saint-Ferien de Champier is the name.
I've never heard that name before.
He's a French humanist.
Okay.
And I think he's probably closely related to, what's his name? Who wrote Pantagruel?
Shit.
Why is it not coming to me?
Rabelais.
Yeah, Rabelais.
Yeah.
Exactly. Who? Because Rabelais quotes Picatrix.
What?
In Pantagruel. He doesn't quote it. He says that it's like some demonic book, or it's. I think the quote is the Reverend. I actually can pull it up here just so I'm not misquoting him.
I can edit this so it looks like you've got it right on the tip of your tongue.
Oh, so here it is. The widespread infamy of this textbook throughout Western Europe is attested by the fact that François Rabelais, in one of his novels, harangued against a certain Picatrice, a, quote, reverend father in the devil and a rector of the diabolical faculty. So
awesome.
So like this is Rabelais' time is like peak time for this stuff to be circulating around in circles. So Agostino Nifo, for example, called the Picatrix the foremost among the Magi, and then other people condemned it as, you know, Picatrix was a Spanish charlatan who wrote about magic. And so
they thought Picatrix was a person,
which he was. So this is where it gets complicated.
And
all of this is actually laid out in the introduction of our book when it comes out, but I can give kind of a crash course on it here. The guy who wrote its name was Maslama al-Qurtubi, right? Okay. So Maslama was the part of the name that when it entered into Spanish, somebody thought, how am I going to translate the name Maslama in Arabic into phonetic Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
We're not. We're just going to give him a code name. So in Arabic, the stem or I guess it's S-L-M backwards, means to bite or to sting. And so in Spanish, picar means to bite or to sting, kind of like a snake. And the idea is like, you know how the serpent's wisdom, you get bit by a serpent and it gives you its wisdom. So it was this notion. And then picar became it would be picator or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then that became Picatrix. And that's the name that he went through Europe as the Picatrix, which means the goader or the biter or the stinger. And the idea is, I think, a serpent
who
bites you with wisdom.
That is cool. I had not heard that before at all. That is bizarre. Huh.
You know what the weird part is that like, so remember how I said that everybody used to think that it was written by a guy named Al-Majridi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Al-Majridi's name is also Maslama Al-Majridi, so the pun would have worked for both of these guys. So it's like, it took me forever to try to untangle all this stuff, and then finally, you know, once you see it clearly, it's easy, but that was one of the things, I think, a major kind of breakthrough for me was just finding out who wrote this thing.
Did you find anything else out about Al-Qurtubi? Did you find any, you know, I mean, what do we know about him as an individual? Like, did he
very little.
Oh, okay. Well,
I mean, what we would know, see, that there's a problem, because it's like, what I know about him is I know the text that he wrote, the Picatrix, right? So I know it's like valuable to him, what he thinks is important, what like what kind of what his worldview was in a way. But I know that secondhand through a Latin translation. I can't read the Arabic and what he wrote. And we don't have any other of his works. So our knowledge about him is fairly scant, but you know, the book is so big, and you know, when somebody gives you 224 books of theirs, like imagine you inherit some, I've inherited somebody's library. I had a landlord, and her husband was like a rapist or something and went to jail. And he was like a university professor and I inherited his library, and he had just like a ton of all the Nietzsche, like, and like just ton of like Wittgenstein and like just great philosophy stuff. So it was really unfortunate that he turned out to be a shitty person, but, I got to know him through a bit of his book collection.
Right.
And like this is your echo chamber. These are the ideas rattling around your head. So Picatrix is a bit like that, where I'm like, okay, these are 224 books that you've compiled.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I know what you think is important, and that's kind of my window into his life. Beyond that, there's not much that I can know. Maybe some Islamic scholars or Arabic scholars would be in a much better position to do that kind of research.
Well, I think from the amount of animal sacrifice that he included in the Picatrix, we can be sure that he was not a vegan.
No, definitely not.
So the Picatrix ended up influencing a lot of people in the Renaissance, and then it kind of just dropped off the face of the earth, or people stopped paying attention to it for a while, right? Like, when did people stop looking at it? Did the Golden Dawn use the Picatrix at all? I don't think there's any Picatrix stuff in the Golden Dawn. Except maybe...
Nope, there was no version of it.
Yeah, I guess they probably had some secondary stuff, like through Agrippa or something like that, but...
Well, they had, like, the Lesser Key of Solomon and all that kind of stuff, which is later, right? But so that stuff is later, and it is in... And, I mean, there's a lot of those books, but they are definitely in the vein that Picatrix began in the West.
Yeah.
You know, Picatrix isn't the only book, but it's one of the major ones, and it's one of the so like Frances Yates writes a lot about Picatrix in her Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. And I was also looking at Wouter Hanegraaff's criticisms of Yates and how she sees this kind of hermetic tradition where there may necessarily not be one. But one of the ways he does this is by looking at her footnotes, and he says, look, you cite like the Corpus Hermeticum, you cite the Asclepius, like 30 times, whereas you don't cite very many other works from it. So to what extent is this really inspired by hermeticism? But I checked his index and just looking through all of his stuff, and I don't see any mention of the Picatrix. And that is arguably one of these Ur Hermetic texts, because Hermes Trismegistus, he appears numerous times in this book. And like, there are all sorts of, he's one of many sages. But I think that it doesn't undercut his argument, but I think he could strengthen his argument by adding in a discussion about the Picatrix and how that also kind of was another vein other than Ficino's translation of the Corpus Hermeticum into this kind of hermetic revival, if you want to call it that.
Which Hanegraaff book was that? Was that in...
Esotericism and the Academy is the one where he talks about a lot of this stuff.
I have a book that's critical of Yeats that's called Francis Yeats and the Hermetic Tradition.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen that one?
Everybody is... No, I haven't. But everybody's critical of Yeats, and it's fair to be critical of Yeats because she was... basically, like, she found what she was looking for, right? She had in mind what she wanted to find before she went looking, and then she kind of, like, cherry-picked to build that narrative. And so it's like she did a lot of great in the sense that she connected magic and science and those two kind of scholarly worlds, and she got people looking into magic seriously, mm-hmm. and like treating a scholarship about magic like seriously, and that it wasn't just like, you know, some fancy. It was a legitimate object of historical inquiry, and that's where I think her greatest contribution is. But when it comes to like actually hashing out the details, I think people are getting pretty good at going to the sources, and there's just like there's like a critical mass of information that we've reached, and mm-hmm. it's too hard to create these kind of linear narratives. You got to branch out into like they're trees that branch off in all directions. That's mm-hmm. how you have to think about it, instead of a line that goes from, you know, magic to science.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, I mean, there is kind of because there's no one single thread that runs through all of it. There's so many different passages and connections. It's kind of hard to put it all together.
Right. And that's kind of the fun of it, though, like, mm-hmm. is parsing it all.
All right, so the Picatrix, let's go back in time a little bit, like, before the Picatrix. Yep. So the Picatrix, it was compiled in the 9th century.
10th century.
10th century, and that's pretty close to the same time as, like, I think, like, the Sworn Book of Honorius was around there. Was that a couple? Yes. Yeah, and then...
Well, that's later, but it fits into that tradition and the idea that, like, mm-hmm. you know, there are... Pope is a necromancer.
Right. what about the Higramantia? I haven't actually read that one yet, but is that older than the Picatrix? Do you know?
I'm unfamiliar with that title. Okay.
Well, I've just recently started seeing people mention it, so it's on my list of things to look up and read, but cool. The Picatrix draws together all of these disparate sources, or like all of these different influences. Do you think it has a pretty direct connection to some of the like Greek magical papyri stuff?
Oh, definitely. It is that. Like, mm-hmm. it might not be that those very recipes mm-hmm. Practiced by that particular magus, I think, in Egypt in, what, the 3rd century AD, mm-hmm. Or maybe 2nd century, but it definitely taps into most of all the Neoplatonic and kind of Hellenic or Hellenization of Egyptian magic. Mm-hmm. That's kind of its bread and butter. And that's kind of what I mean also when I say Platonic Orientalism is this kind of retroprojection of Greek philosophy through an aesthetic lens of Egyptian culture and society. And then that becomes in and of itself a kind of like a real experience of Egyptian, of what you perceive to be Egyptian religion, but it is actually like a modern, or not modern, contemporary to the 3rd and 4th century mm-hmm. construction.
Right, right.
All these philosophies, all these like debates coming together, mystery cults from all the four corners of the earth, like everybody in a giant mixing pool, Jews, Christians, mm-hmm. Everybody contributing all these ideas and trying to hash them out. Like mm-hmm. that's the bread and butter of the worldview that feeds into the Picatrix, and the Arabs inherit that, right? Because mm-hmm. they take Egypt and they take Spain as well, where there's like a huge wealth of like when Toledo falls, mm-hmm. that's just like there's so much wealth and knowledge that falls from the Muslims back into Christian. Well, when you say back into it, complicates the picture. We'll just say it goes from Muslim to Christian hands.
Yeah, that's easier. So then what other sort of sources or have you guys managed to identify any other sources for the Picatrix? Like what
He names them. So there's yeah, when you're reading it, you just like, he's like, I found in a book by a certain guy named blah, blah, blah in his book called, and then it's italicized. And then,
I guess
he'll just drop citations.
Yeah. Like in book four, he's got like, here's a list of spells that I got from blah, blah, blah. Found in a book that was discovered in the Church of Coradib.
Chamber of Queen. Cordoba, right.
And Queen...
It's in the book of Queen Cleopatra.
Is it Cleopatra? It says Folopedre in this...
Oh, no, that's a Spanish queen.
Oh, okay.
And so this is like a later amendment or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And then I loved... It's just like, the spells are just sometimes so weird.
Yeah.
Here's one.
Some of them are just truly bizarre.
To gather mice in one place. To catch birds sleeping in trees.
Oh yeah, well, and that, so that's like interesting because it's like you can reconstruct people's kind of like worldview or like what their day-to-day life was by figuring out what the things that they couldn't achieve through regular means were. So like you'll find that a huge quantity of the spells are dedicated to pests.
Oh yeah,
insects, bed bugs, bugs in your wine,
getting rid of rats, like,
or even
using pests as stuff. Enemies, like inflicting snake bites on your enemies, or one another one was to summon a green tarantula that'll bite people.
That's actually like a one of those weird things where you're like, is this like golem construction? Like what are you talking about when you're bringing things to life? Are you imitating nature or are you recreating nature? So are you playing God in their worldview? Are you playing God or are you kind of emulating him? And there was a lot of anxiety, especially around the practice of alchemy in the 13th century as to whether you were playing God by perfecting nature, by turning, you know, crap into gold, among other things, or were you simply, you know, doing an art that improved nature, but that didn't necessarily like perfect it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the golem thing itself, you know, Arya Kaplan interprets the golem as a mental construct, as like an imaginal form of life instead of like an actual like walking around form, which I think is pretty interesting. And you know, through that lens you can view all sorts of some of the old books of magic. You've probably read Ioan Culiano. I don't know if I say his name right. I can't speak Italian.
I don't think I have.
He wrote Eros and Magic in the Renaissance.
No, but I should put that on my list if it's not already on my list.
I would love to hear your thoughts about that book. That book completely like changed the way that I looked at like Renaissance magic and all the old magic stuff. It was just sort of like, oh crap, I didn't realize. You know, a lot of it is about sort of dissecting and putting back together like the way that the Renaissance worldview worked. So like the way people thought before, and he sort of pins a lot of blame for the loss of that kind of thought on the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. And
yeah, nominalism especially is the philosophy that destroyed the magical worldview.
Nominalism? What's nominalism?
I don't know. So nominalism is the belief, and it is the first non-nominalist position that was ever expressed in the world's history was Plato's worldview. So Plato was the first idealist.
Okay.
So idealism in the Middle Ages became realism. So like the idealism of Plato became the realism of the Middle Ages, and nominalism were the first people to look at that and go, oh wait, there are no general universal things. Like there is no humanity. That's the traditional example. There are individual humans. And when we say humanity, we aren't actually like reaching into some Platonic form and touching the like true archetype of mankind. That such a thing doesn't exist. What there is just many individual humans. And we're using words, nomen, to map reality. And so now that that was like a pretty revolutionary thing within scholasticism, within the medieval debate system. But what happened was Martin Luther was one of these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was he took nominalism and started applying that to things like the Eucharist. And once the signifier and the signified, so the thing that is symbolized and the symbol itself, or rather the symbol itself and the thing symbolized, mm-hmm. once that was cut apart and separated, it created like a cascade where it just crumbled apart the magical worldview of medieval Catholicism with the cult of the saints, with mm-hmm. image veneration, with everything was linked in the mind in these magical categories. And nominalism said, no, actually, like, you're not eating Jesus. You're eating a symbol of Jesus. And then they go, oh, shit. Like, and so it's like, no, you're not, like, that's not, the map is not the territory, is mm-hmm. Alfred Korchipsky said that. And that's basically the nominalist premise. And in religion, there was a critical mass of belief with Catholicism. So, you know, everybody believed in it, and it was just kind of, that was reality. All of the worldview of medieval Catholicism became reality. And then somebody came along and said, well, actually, you know, these terms that you're talking about, like truth or love or whatever, like, they aren't actually abstracts. They're things that are particular cases. So you have particular instances of love. You don't really have like love. You just have individual loves. Hmm. And that that sort of extended to all aspects of society, and it fundamentally destroyed the magical worldview. And it's part, it is part of triggering the scientific revolution of people seeing clearly. So, but there's two sides to it, right? So like there's the side that's like, I want to live in Aboriginal dream time, European Aboriginal dream time, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Which was medieval Catholicism. You know, it was brutal and dirty and nasty and all that, but it was still like you had a sense of belonging and community, and everything was based on, you know, communal ties and bonds. And once Protestantism kind of erodes away at that, it really gives birth again to the individual. And you get ideas like the Protestant work ethic, and we could talk about whether that's real or not, or
well, whether it's real or not, it sure has shaped a lot of society.
Exactly. And that was Max Weber's idea, was that Protestants created what's called an iron cage.
Oh yeah.
And the iron cage, like, we shed the religious baggage, but we maintained the structure of, you know, self-discipline. You've always got, any time that you aren't working, mm-hmm. that's money wasted that you could be saving up, because if you're saving that money, then you've got like compound interest, and then you're making more money. So mm-hmm. then you should always be working, but not spending it, because that's blasphemy, and you don't want to spend too much money because you'll be polluted by luxury or whatever. Yeah. So we are shaped by those people's thinking, but largely devoid of, you know, the religious component, which is very alien to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Max Weber's thought, I thought, shoehorned in really nicely with Cugliano. Like, Cugliano talks about the Reformation, and, you know, I don't think he uses the word nominalism. I think he pins a lot of it on, he seems to interpret Luther's attack on, you know, images and the cult of saints as purely sort of this ideological anti-Catholic thing. And then he says that, you know, the tradition sort of continued, you know, the Counter-Reformation cracked down on the cult of saints and images and iconography right. in the church. To the point where I can't remember his exact words, but he calls it something like, the the institutional murder of the imagination or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why I call it the death of a European dream time.
Yeah. Which is sad.
I haven't heard anybody else use that, but
I feel like we should totally, we should tweet that, the death of European dream time.
Yeah. But then are you familiar with monarchist Twitter? Like, they're out there, like people who want that, but they're usually pretty like hardcore right wingers who want to bring back monarchy. And like the crusader spirit.
I don't want those.
They LARP as crusaders on, right. So there you go.
maybe it's okay for European Dreamtime to stay dead, but maybe we need a new Dreamtime.
Yeah. I just think we need to remember that there was such a thing and that you actually can get lost in those things. Especially in today's discourse about colonialism and things like that, mm-hmm. People always like to think that, you know, Europeans figured out science and then all of a sudden they were in the four corners of the earth just like ruining everybody's traditional cultures. But the fact is, like, Europe destroyed its own traditional worldview from within before it started spreading that elsewhere. So it's like nobody was spared from the ravages of nominalism, science, industrialization, capitalism, etc.
I mean, in a way, Europe destroyed its own traditional culture like two or three times since we've had recorded history. Like, it's Europe just loves to eat itself.
Yep.
Man, there's a whole graveyard of dream times out there somewhere.
Yep, and that's
in a more ideal world.
Yeah, but that's for me, that's the essence of it, right? Like, mm-hmm. my fascination, my interest in all of this is, like, I want to try to see what it would be like to be in those dream times.
So I
look at like various religions as these provisional models that I kind of surf through, but I try to understand them on their own terms. Because if you try to bring to bear too many modern concepts on like the ancient world, it starts to distort mm-hmm. the vision that you're having, and you end up retro projecting all this modern baggage. So, you know, you try to do it historically and see things from their own perspectives as much as possible, because mm-hmm. obviously you can't. Totally. I think that's the essence of scholarship, is just kind of trying to get clear vision and mm-hmm. and see things as clearly as possible, and always be willing to reconceptualize how you think about these various models.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you're comfortable answering this sort of question. Have you ever performed a ritual out of the Picatrix, or have you ever performed any Picatrix operations?
No. I mean, I have some funny stories about this. Like, to me, I think I think that very few people actually ever do magic correctly, right? Because it's like Picatrix mm-hmm. is like, you can't just like open a book and then like point your finger to like, I'm going to do this one.
Yeah.
And then do it. You actually have to read the entire book and understand the entire system mm-hmm. in order to do it properly. Because there are like, there might be a line in the second book somewhere in like paragraph 32, which is like an important maxim that governs everything else in the book.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Or it'll be like, there'll be some sort of astrological warning. It's like, oh yeah, and by the way, if these two things are happening in the sky, nothing else is going to work.
Exactly. And so it's like, I don't actually have the like capacity or wherewithal. Also, like, our systems are incommensurable. Mm-hmm. I don't view the world from a Copernic or from a Ptolemaic or Aristotelian worldview. Mm-hmm. Like, And much of the magic that's in the Picatrix hinges on understanding the world in this worldview, mm-hmm. where the earth is at the center and there are like concentric rings of crystalline spheres, which have star power like emanating down from the Empyrean, and they're being shaped and altered by various planet like configurations of the stars and planets.
Yeah.
I don't see the world that way, right? Like, mm-hmm. I am a scientific thinker. I, you know, for me, the decentralization of the, you know, Earth happened in 1600 with Giordano Bruno. Mm-hmm. Like, it, so for me, I don't have the belief or the, you know, that kind of rigor in order to like convince myself that that's the way that the world works in order for the magic to work in the way that it ought to work. Mm-hmm. I would have to do all sorts of adaptations. And then where does that end? Right. Like,
right.
Okay, well, there are seven planets here. Well, now we know that like those are two luminaries and that there are more planets. So I'm going to add Pluto and Neptune and Uranus. And then I'm going to like, oh, well, I know about like certain adjustments in the Gregorian calendar, so I'm going to have to modulate for those. And then, oh, there are certain adjustments that I have to make in terms of like the parallax of phenomenon that were never known in the Middle Ages. And so it's like, I'm not going to do all that. What I would rather do is like learn that worldview and try to like understand it, but not necessarily practice it, or because I have my own, my own kind of spiritual worldview that is incommensurable with that one. Mm-hmm. But I will still like try as hard as I can to understand it as a historian, so that I can do an accurate translation and capture the meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like a lot of people, when they look at a translation, they might say like, oh, it's not literal, or it's not like word for word the same. And I'm like, if you did that, it would come out as crap. Like it would come out as like garbled, meaningless stuff. You have to interpret what you have to like translate it and then be like, okay, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you cannot tap into the meaning because it's, you're so far gone in your worldview, that's fine. You just leave it as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But most cases you can make an informed decision about how you ought to order something in order to, uncover the meaning of what the author actually meant.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I haven't done any rituals from it for fear that I would immediately mess them up. And then also there, I have some like a funny story. There was, I won't name names. In 2012, I was finishing my MA at Waterloo and getting ready to go to California for 2 years. And mm-hmm. I was at UCLA there. And so basically my position as co-translator was being relieved and they were looking for somebody else who could take on the job, because in the way that the university works with funding, they can't just keep funding the same person over and over again.
Uh-huh.
They have to like spread it out to give as much funding to as many masters or PhD students as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to give this translation work to this woman. And she was down. And then once she sat down and opened it and started learning about it,
mm-hmm.
immediately was totally freaked out and said, I don't want anything to do with this project. I don't want my name associated with this. I don't want any affiliation. This is satanic magic. And I just like, and so she was clearly like a fundamentalist
mm-hmm.
Christian who really took issue with even being associated with any work of, you know, quote unquote demonology.
Oh,
right. Because that's what it is.
Yeah, it's just totally.
Like, what do you define demons as? Right. Mm-hmm. Like
they're planets. Demons are planets.
Yeah. And exactly. And that's the thing. It's pretty unambiguous in the Picatrix that when you're summoning these things, you are summoning the spirits of planets. And so like planets have various spirits and you are invoking one or another of mm-hmm. the spirit of Jupiter
mm-hmm.
and then getting them to do that work for you. But it's funny to know that there are people who like turn down the project just because of magic paranoia.
That's awesome. So, how, in your best estimate, how many more months do we have to wait before this new Picatrix is out, before your translation is out?
By contract, it is due out in the first quarter of 2019, and it is in the publisher's best interest, and they know this, to publish before there's an international medieval congress that I go to every year. I'm actually going to it this year in May in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Oh, that sounds exciting. And
it's super great. Like, I go every year. It's rad. I give a talk.
Wait, tell me that everybody shows up in, like, Ren Faire clothing to this, too.
No, actually, damn. And I get this every time I cross the border. There's always some smart-ass border guard who's like, where are you guys going? And I'm just like, we're going to a medieval conference. And he's just like, you got any axes or maces? And I'm like, no, it's like a scholarly conference. He's like, what about chainmail? You got any chainmail? And I'm just like, no. We're just like reading papers and getting drunk.
Well,
and he's like,
do you
okay,
think maybe,
move along, sir.
Maybe you could change the conference so that all the scholars showed up like dressed like monks and with chainmail. Like, I think that would be really cool.
Well, it's great because it's the Societas Magica, right? So they're like, they write a lot of the books that are, say, in the Magic and History series. And they're a great crowd, and it's nice to just, like, every year, consistently, everybody, all the scholars in that group get together and do panels and present what they've been doing every year. And so you get a really solid sense of the scholarly community. And that's why I've been trying to, like, link up this side with the European side, because... The European side is kind of like doing its own thing. And then like the Societas Magica people seem to be doing their own thing. I mean, I don't know all of their individual paths or wills or whatever, but from what I've noticed, like in terms of reading citations in bibliographies and stuff like that, there's not as much crossover in the North American and European scholarship world. So I would like to see that bridged.
Yeah, I would too. I feel like I get a lot more, like, I think most of the books I have are from, like, University of Amsterdam type people, you know, like Hanegraaff and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that stuff's awesome.
Like, it is awesome, yeah. I love Hanegraaff. I've never met him in person, but I imagine that he's sort of, like, really grumpy.
Yeah, I think that's a shtick. That's just, like, the continental scholar shtick. Yeah, you're a professional. You're paid to be, like, austere and have auctoritas and like the more you exude that, the more you excel in that world.
You've got to have a tweed jacket and reading glasses that you wear down on the end of your nose.
Exactly, totally.
And
whereas like here it's like it's a different ball game, like it's all about just nice and being cordial and friendly and like, yes, being right, but also like mainly only in your publications. Like nobody wants to hear you berate people at conference. Not that I'm saying these people do that either, but there's a definitely like a different climate of attitudes from the European scene to the North American scene.
Well, I just want you to promise that you are going to make a ton of noise on the internet once the Picatrix comes out so that
I will.
Everybody
I
knows
mean,
that.
And this is part of it, right? Like I've gotten, I think like 6 or 7 podcast requests. So I started with yours because you asked me first.
Oh, great.
And so I'm like, okay, I've got to start like dealing with this pile of requests. And this is my equivalent of, you know, starting buzz or whatever the marketing term for it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I totally understand. And you know, I'm glad that we spent all this time talking about the Picatrix, but there's a ton of stuff that we could talk about again. So I'll probably bug you in a few months, get you on the podcast again so we could dig into some of your other things. But for now, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on the internet?
All right. So on YouTube, it's youtube.com/themodernhermeticist and, you know, no spaces. And on Twitter, it's twitter.com/modernhermetics.
Okay.
At the time, the modern hermeticist didn't fit. And themodernhermeticist.com as well is kind of my website.
Great. Okay. I'll put links to all that stuff in the show notes. And then we're My Alchemical Bromance at myalchemicalbromance.com. And you can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and all that stuff. So thank you very much, Dan. Go forth and hermeticize.
Yes. Thank you, Eric. You as well.
My Alchemical Bromance is sponsored by Miskatonic Books. Miskatonic Books is an online bookstore that focuses on rare, limited edition, and custom-made books of the highest quality. They specialize in books on the occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, and other topics of interest to you, our listeners. Check them out on the web at miskatonicbooks.com.
I'm not going to be able to do that.